Adventure Explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Oh, my friends, welcome, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive, and we're going to try and keep it that way tonight. We have got some excellent, excellent information for you tonight. The solar wind is a very mild 292.4 kilometers per second. Sunspot 944 has just returned over the limb of the sun, but there are no coronal holes, and Sunspot 944 poses no threat for solar flares. And yet, Nuuk is located near Earth's aurora oval, where northern lights shimmer most constantly. It's a good place to be on a regular night, and a great place to be during a geomagnetic storm. I'm looking forward to the display when the solar wind actually arrives, Mr. Christensen says. Comet 2P, Encke, is approaching Earth, and it's bringing a puzzle. On February 22nd, veteran comet observer Mike Holloway of Van Buren, Arkansas, photographed 2PNT. The comet is the fuzzy blob in the middle of this picture. We're going to show it to you on our website at x2-radio.com. But there are strange spikes sticking out either side. It all makes sense, except for one thing. The trail should be too faint for Holloway's 5-inch telescope. The last time Enki's trail was seen, in 2002, astronomers needed a 16-hour exposure on Kitt Peak's 2.3-meter telescope to find it. A 7-minute exposure on a backyard telescope should not be adequate, yet there it is. Strange things in space. We are nearing spring of the most amazing year in known history. You might not know it yet because you're new to X Squared Radio, but we go a little past your imagination on a regular basis here. If you're here, you're already part of something amazing. A little studio deep beneath the earth in western Kentucky is now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. You make it that way. So tell your friends about us. And if you're listening to us on a broadcast radio, remember, this program lasts for 3 hours, so if your station is not bringing all 3 hours to you, send us the call letters, and we'll do the rest. You have heard us talk here at X Squared Radio about the beginning of the Spirit Race. Well, there are more details coming on March 25th. Last month, we had Ken Payne on the radio. Then we had Maureen St. Germain. Next month, we will unlock the secret for you. You will finally have the tools you need to manifest your dreams into reality. Of course, that means you're going to have to start dreaming big, really big. We'll tell you more about it in upcoming programs. Next week, we have a super treat for you. Rob Simone is not only a world explorer, published author, and great lecturer. He has hosted a talk radio program in London and now in Los Angeles. You can see him in the new movie Fast Walkers, which just premiered a couple of weeks ago. You can see him at any of numerous expos and conferences this year, and next Sunday you will hear him on X Squared Radio. Be here with Rob Simone next week. Last week we were supposed to have Mark Pinkham on the program to talk about his book Guardians of the Holy Grail. We didn't hook up, but March 11th he will be back with us for sure. If you have ever had any questions about the role of the Holy Grail and what it had in world history, and maybe why we find ourselves in such an international mess, then come aboard X Squared Radio on March 11th. You'll get the truth. This week, we have a rare experience for you. Our guest started out as an incredible artist who has his career as a forensic artist, rendering the faces of criminals for law enforcement. Before long, he began drawing the faces of off-worlders seen by numerous people who have had experiences. He has become the world's most prolific and outspoken leader in the UFO witnessing world. He is here with us tonight, but trust me, we will go places with him that perhaps no host has allowed him to go in the past. You're here with me and my guest, Bill McDonald. Welcome, my friend. How are you?
It's good to be with you, Brooks.
I know you're recovering. I know you're recovering from physical illness, but I know that once we drop the quartering and light the fuse, you'll be just fine.
Well, just remember, the energy of my spirit is at full throttle. It's only my voice that's failing me. So if people will bear with me and be patient, that won't be a problem because I will be conveying an enormous amount of information in a very short period of time.
That's right. This is the fastest 3 hours in talk radio. Well, Bill, you have been on the inside of a community that the vast majority of the world has never seen. We all have our hopes and fears about life from other worlds or even from our own world. When did you first get involved with the UFO community and how did it affect you?
Well, the journey began while I was still serving as an undercover private investigator and in military service back in the 1980s. I was traveling through the Southwest Desert on a helicopter, and we pulled into a base in New Mexico to refuel. And the base is one of the assets that's actually aboard the White Sands Test Range, and it has a particular nickname. And we were there, and we were there only by special permission and only to refuel. They had three hangars in the vicinity of a chalk formation. And what ended up happening was somebody had left the hangar door open, and I saw something that looked vaguely like a saucer that was parked. And this was years ago. But it was parked, and it was on wheels. So it was not like the radar dish that goes on top of an AWACS or Viking aircraft. Whatever this thing was, it had its own landing gear. And the landing gear looked like the normal landing gear for terrestrial fighter aircraft, even though this object itself was clearly a disc with a very small dome at the apex and no other markings on it whatsoever. Now, that piqued my interest, but only vaguely. It was a very busy time of life for me. There were a lot of assignments, and I really had no interest in flying saucers whatsoever. The next opportunity for me to become involved with flying saucers came in 1992 when I began to make plans to leave military service and the Associated Detective Agency and go off on my own. I needed to get away from my contractual obligations, and I was looking for a way where folks would just, you know, let me go. And I met some ghost hunters in Los Angeles while attending a game show tryout for Bill Cosby. And these people happened to know the publishers of UFO Magazine, which at the time was Vicki Cooper Ecker and her soon-to-be future husband, Don Ecker, and a lady by the name of Sherry Stark, who was the co-partner and art director of the magazine. And this was in the years before Bill Burns and all those other people that became involved with the current incarnation of the magazine. And I ended up doing a number of covers, artwork for covers for UFO Magazine, as well as interior sketches, designed in such a way that they could be easily published with the primitive publishing means that was available to them at the time. And, you know, my artwork took off. I had been using my art and my photography for many, many years as a cover for when I was doing undercover assignments overseas and different locations, as well as, you know, my career in the Marine Corps, which was also of sorts, a cover for the work I was doing when I wasn't on duty. So time came where that detective agency was being asked to relocate to Kuwait City, Kuwait. It was after the end of the conclusion of the first Gulf War. And I was basically being asked to become an expatriate forever, you know, live overseas in the Middle East, you know, live like a king, have a ball, but probably not see America again for 10 or 20 years, if that. I didn't want to do that, so I opted to quit. That didn't go over very well with the people I was working with, and I basically put in all the papers and made all the moves and burned all the bridges that I needed to do in order to get loose. At the same time, I needed something to keep me going financially. I also needed something that would give me some notoriety, something that would keep me at least in the public eye in some way to where I wouldn't get messed with. And fortunately for me, the UFO community was there at the right time in the right place. UFO Magazine was there. People that I met because of UFO Magazine were there. They introduced me to Paul Davids, Jeremy Kagan, through Kevin Randall, and I ended up doing the spaceships and the initial design sketches for the bodies for the movie Roswell, which was came out on Showtime on July 4th of 1994. And once I was involved with that movie, Roswell, I was able to land 8 different TV series within a year and a half. And I was the only person ever to work for both sightings and encounters simultaneously without getting canned by one or the other, because both shows originated as Paramount Television's Encounters, and the assets had been divided, with one group going to Paramount Television and becoming Sightings, and the other group going to Fox Television and becoming Fox's Encounters, and they were suing each other for the entire 3 to 5 seasons that they were going. And I was the forensic artist and concept artist for both programs, and I worked for the producers for both programs, and I managed to not get myself involved in the dogfight that everybody else was involved in. And so I can truthfully say that both programs are, you know, part of my portfolio and, you know, on my list of credits. I ended up being a consultant to numerous segment producers on Unsolved Mysteries, kind of a behind-the-scenes brain. I was a consultant for some of the people at Fox for a number of the sci-fi TV series that were out at the time. Some of my military and counterintelligence corps witnesses were giving me configurations on vehicles built both by us and by outsiders from outside the Earth's atmospheric envelope that allowed me to showcase some of these designs through television. And eventually I hooked up with the Tester Corporation, who had just completed a project with Bob Lazar on the Lazar UFO that had been claimed since 1989. That Lazar UFO probably broke all sales records and beat out all of the Star Trek model kits and most of the car model kits and all the other popular model kits before computer games became very sophisticated and model kits were still a real big deal in most children's lives and many adults too. And my tester model kits of the Roswell UFO came out in 1997 on the 4th of July, which was the 50th anniversary of the crash. And 2 years later, my resin kit of the crash site itself also came out with testers, and those broke sales records. So I was very proud of that fact. And whenever you see a tester model kit of the Roswell UFO on eBay or on a store shelf or in some private collector's hands, that thing's worth a lot of money. If you get it to me without breaking its wrapper and I sign it, it has an intrinsic value of approximately $500. If you decide to break the wrapper, open it up, and build it, it has an intrinsic value of $15 to $20. So some people like to build them, and some people like to collect them with my signature on the box. But
it sounds to me like you got involved in the UFO community in the entertainment end of it.
The entertainment thing was simply my way of getting my name and the information out quick.
Right.
It got me a modest paycheck, but more importantly, it got my name out there, and it gave me enough attention to where my former employers would leave me alone.
Right.
So,
but in any of this, it was a manifestation of your superb ability to see.
Well, it absolutely, and the reason why was because I'm a forensic artist. I don't know anything about aerospace, but I sat down with members who were dying of the United States Army Counterintelligence Corps, which was an elite army unit of secret agents that served in the Second World War. They had two missions. In the Atlantic theater, in the European theater, their job was to hunt down German spies who specialized in collection of intelligence against the Russians. In the Pacific theater, their task was to locate witnesses and officers within the Japanese Imperial Forces that might be able to put America onto the physical location of Yamamoto's gold, an enormous treasure trove of gold that had been hoarded by the Japanese, by Admiral Yamamoto. And these people were then taken by the Army, and nine of them were transferred to, in 1943, to the security of the atom bomb development program that was going on at Los Alamos and at Sandia Labs and all of the various locations where the components for the atomic bomb were being developed in 1944 and 1945. They were the special agents in charge of doing whatever needed to be done to keep enemy spies and reporters away from the atom bomb. And they were the atom bomb security agents. And these were the people who, in 1947, recovered the UFO that crashed 32 miles north of Roswell on BLM land leased to Judd McKnight and Jason Ridgway, the area that's known as Hubcorn's Ranch today. These people had observed the vehicle up close. I interviewed four major witnesses and over 28 minor witnesses, and all of them had descriptions of the vehicle that dovetailed enough that I was able to produce a batwing-shaped kind of a cross between a wave rider and a ground-effect aircraft that was absolutely seamless, that the layers of its hull were grown, not manufactured through sub-assemblies like cars and airplanes are here on Earth,
right,
and whose interior components mimic the function, structures, and forms of the internal organs of biological organisms, even though it was made out of metals and exotic crystal and, elements in various layers. Alien technology mimics the function, structure, and form of the tissue inside of various types of oceanic sea life, which is far more efficient than the kind of engineering structures that the military and the public sector develops for various electronic devices today. The technology is easily 10,000 years in advance of ours and is considered biomorphic, biomimetic, and biomemnetic in scientific description. And as a physicist, you would understand this. The interesting thing is I'm not an aerospace designer. I don't know how to design a new aircraft because I'm not an engineer. I have not the education in that area. But the vehicle that I described based on the composite, the general composite of the Roswell spacecraft, when fed into a computer and when models were actually created and put in a wind tunnel, it was discovered to be the ultimate aerospace shape or form for any kind of vehicle. It doesn't matter if it's a slow flyer or a hypersonic vehicle, surfing its own shockwave in the upper atmosphere, which is what a wave rider is.
Wow.
This thing is the holy grail of aerospace design. And I'm a private detective that draws what people tell me. I don't have the slightest background in aircraft design. And yet, people like Hal Puthoff and Eric Davis and the NIDS people and the people at the Institute for Advanced Studies at Austin, Texas, took a look at my model kit. And took a look at the various measurements and the center of gravity and the configurational shape of the wings and the way the wings blended into the body of this thing. It was like a cross between a stingray and a porpoise. And it turns out that it is the most miraculous transatmospheric aircraft design imaginable. And as if that wasn't enough, this thing could dive into a body of salt water and fly out again, just like the fly-in sub from the old Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea series, because its propulsion was such that its skin was in actuality its engine. Its life support system was not an atmosphere. It was a supercritical fluid similar to the compounds of freon-type compounds that are highly oxygenated, that the military has been very secretly drowning Navy SEALs in and then bringing them out again over and over again. Just like in that old movie, The Abyss.
The Abyss, right. The deep sea diving fluid that they put the rat in.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, we've all seen videos of rats drowned in this fluid and then brought out again. They hold them upside down, they choke the stuff out, and then they're back breathing here with no harm, no foul. Well, the same thing happens to these Navy SEALs over the last 30 years that have been involved in deep, deep diving where they're breathing a supercritical fluid rather than a atmosphere. And, of course, they're not subject to the bends, and they're not subject to the pressure variances, and they don't suffer as badly from, as many problems as atmospheric divers do. So,
subject to the forces of left-hand turns at 10,000.
Well, now, that's the other thing. When you are encased in a fluid and your console and your crash couch is gripping you with tiny little hooks, like the tiny little tendrils of a sea anemone, which is very poorly mimicked in the concept of Velcro. What you end up with is the kind of restraint system that allows you to turn on a dime, that allows you to experience the most enormous inertial forces when changing direction without having your body fluids just slam all over the place, without, you know, making you a bloody spot at the back of the cabin wall, without you passing out from forces so strong that they kill you by shutting down your central nervous system. And this life support system inside the vehicle gave the vehicle a slightly positive but almost neutral buoyancy in salt water. So the thing clearly would dive into the ocean and fool around underwater and then fly out again, surfing various levels of atmosphere, weather fronts, everything. It had what was called morphable camber, meaning the wing edges and the vertical stabilizers, which were inward canted at about 30 degrees, had the ability to adjust and move with metal operating like layers of muscle within a bird's wing. So the thing had no movable flight surfaces. The flight surfaces themselves were morphable and movable as a whole. So this thing could...
through the air and through the water, is the actual skin changed in order to carve a new course through that medium.
Exactly. But the most miraculous thing about the skin itself was the skin was the engine. The mode of propulsion in lower atmosphere and underwater was called magneto-aero-electrodynamics or magneto-hydrodynamics, depending on the environment you're in. That means that electrons and particles move in waves across the skin from the most forward portions, the leading edges and the nose, to the trailing edges and this funny-looking little tailpipe out the back end that seems to shoot a funny pinkish-bluish flame at all times. And what that is free-moving electrons that were blasting off the back.
What kind of speeds could they achieve?
Well, it's like slipping a wet pumpkin seed through your fingers. Literally, the atmosphere was used to push the vehicle through the atmosphere.
I see.
Using electrical means. So the vehicle was able to fly, and then it could hover. It could levitate, and it had these power cells in its belly that could access, amplify, and manipulate magnetic fields. So the thing could slow speed and then hover.
Well, I guess my question is, how did these intelligence people that you were interviewing and thus just drawing this stuff and receiving this kind of download, how did they get this information?
Well, because they recovered the vehicle. See, the Army did, in fact, recover the UFO at Roswell, but it wasn't the regular Army units that did the recovery. The recovery was done by the Provost Marshal and the MPs that had been flown in from four bases in the immediate area. And it was directed by several of the nine members of the United States Army Counterintelligence Corps who were in charge. And the information was conveyed directly to General Clements McMullen and General Martin F. Scanlon and possibly Nathan Twining and a number of other persons in Washington, D.C., directly through their separate chain of command. And, of course, the President of the United States, Harry S. Truman, was told immediately. Now, in my opinion, Harry S. Truman is probably the greatest president in U.S. history because not only did he have to deal with the moral issues of dropping two atomic bombs on an indigenous population in order to end a wider war, but then all of a sudden he had to deal with aliens from outer space for real. And it wasn't just, you know, a fun sci-fi exercise.
Without revealing it to the general public.
Well, you know, it's not so much that. I mean, he was a deeply religious man, and some religious people would literally exhibit immediate health problems related to the kind of stress that that kind of knowledge would inflict. But the buck truly stopped with Harry Truman. As far as I'm concerned, he's the greatest president in U.S. history.
He really did take personal responsibility, and he took it on, and he made tough decisions to save lives. My wonder is, as this was unfolding in 1947, and now the real government people, real investigators were coming to him and saying, Mr. President, this is real. We've recovered a ship. It has advanced technology. We believe we can reverse engineer it, even though everything that was flying at that time was powered by diesel fuel and propellers. And we want to do it. We want to form a budget, and we think that more are coming. And yet he responded to that and never let the public know and created
exactly. Now here's the antithesis of that that followed in the administration immediately following. General Eisenhower wanted nothing to do with this, and he put his vice president in charge of dealing with the UFO issues, and that was Nixon. All of Nixon's personal problems and personal demons were just horribly amplified by his knowledge of the alien presence here on Earth. Nixon was tasked with keeping the secrecy and with the oversight of the subcontractors who were financed first by the CIA and then later by the National Intelligence Agency. And what ended up happening was this knowledge destroyed Nixon. Even as president, Nixon was profoundly and just cripplingly affected by this knowledge. And we saw the results in his pregnancy.
And what knowledge was that really crippled him? What was it?
The knowledge of the activities of the alien presence on Earth and the abductions that were ongoing, the gene harvesting that was ongoing, coring of human beings the way mutilated cattle are sometimes cored out for the soft tissues. That didn't happen often, but it did. There was a small segment of abductees who were not being returned. And all my witnesses verify this. I've got military witnesses who only died, you know, recently, just in the last 12 years, going all the way back to before World War II, that had various keys to the puzzle. I've done all my own research, sole and separate from the other UFO researchers in the UFO community. I've kept my nose to the grindstone. I've stayed out of the UFO community politics as much as I could since I met my wife in 95. And I've just gone about my business of collecting my data and organizing my conclusions.
And what are you going to do? You're going to write a book?
Well, interesting you should ask that. I need a publisher. And if you people are listening and you happen to be a book editor or a publisher, I need to be contacted.
I can help you
out
there.
I have two nonfiction manuscripts related to the alien presence and the Roswell case that I need, you know, some financing so I can complete. And I also have a number of science fiction short stories that are also based on all of the information that I have occurred. Now, the other thing is I have a website that my wife built and that we co-own. And it's called alienufoart.com. And like you, Brooks, my wife is a spiritual healer. And like you, she merges science with spirituality and healing. And so while you'll see my artwork on various pages on the website, and it's a huge website, and while you'll see information pages that I provide based on my research and everything on the website, the vast majority of this website is the healing and the spiritual products and services that my wife provides. And she's also a ghost hunter. So the way for people to contact us, whether their interest is UFOs, whether their interest is healing crystals, anything that they like in the way of any kind of healing crystals and prism hangers and seed crystals and all of that stuff, she has them. And that, again, is www.alienufoart.com. Along with probably the largest free site regarding ghost photos anywhere.
Awesome.
And she also has the alien crystal skulls from all over the world. She has crystal skulls from all over the world, different kinds of rocks. She has aqua aura and tanzine. She has just about every kind of semi-precious stone you can imagine. She's got Merkabas. I'm not even sure what those are, but she's got them. They're shaped like Star of David's. She's got moldavite, probably one of the most amazing collections.
I'm wearing one right now.
Yeah. She's got moldavite angel hangers. She's got all of this stuff. And so while I'm focusing on my research, she's busy financing my research and her own research with her magician stones and the pendants. She's got the pendants that are just like the ones that magician used to kill the dragon in the movie Dragon Slayer, made from all kinds of exotic crystals. She has something called Radiant Heart Crystals that I've not seen before, Stars of David's. So many people know about that stuff. Flower of Life pendants. She's got tons of stuff. Ascension Star pendants, which is another kind of magician kind of pendant that when people wear them and they have certain kinds of illnesses, the illnesses alleviate. Now, as you know, part of that is because of thousands of years of the tradition of association of certain kinds of stones with healing. She also has something about clearing of spaces from negative energy from people who have resided in the area prior to the occupation by the new family. She has faceted quartz crystal domes, just tons of stuff. And that's how we finance our operation, by the way.
Well, I've got the website linked at X Squared Radio. If you just go to the archives, you can get to alienufoart.com.
Right.
So as people access this archive tomorrow morning when they go to work or tonight after the show, you'll be able to access that website. Of course, it's on the website.
Well, now there's something else, though, and you know, I've been leading to this. The entire portfolio, the entire range of commercial images that I have created for TV shows and for books, I'm in like 16 or 17 books. I've been on probably 40 or 50 TV shows, 8 different TV series, the whole thing. All of those artworks are up, and for the first time this year, the originals are now available for sale. So at alienufoart.com, you're going to see an image that I drew recently of an alien that was described as peeking through the bathroom window of a lady down in Texas. And that one is on eBay, on auction right now. And by going to alienufoart.com and clicking on that image, it'll take you right to the commissions page and then over to the eBay store where people can make purchases directly immediately because everything has a buy it now price as well as some of the stuff being on auction. But my entire portfolio is available for purchase, again, to help me with the research because I don't need my original images anymore. The technology of copying and reproducing images has become so good that I no longer need to warehouse my originals. It's time to get my originals out into the world, and because I've got the images permanently for publication and for my own reference. And so alienufoart.com is the place to buy the most cutting-edge alien and UFO and various kinds of artwork that there is. I even do religious themes. I do wildlife. I do science fiction-type assignments. I've done Godzillas for the Japanese. My dragons are highly sought after by Asian clients everywhere. And one of these days when you and I are talking, I've got to tell you about the story of dragons and where they come from because there are actually fossils pulled out of a sea cave near Surabaya that actually support the existence of these animals in ancient times. And, you know, another interesting thing, Brooks, is I maintain a timeline of human history. Every key significant event that has gone on since humanity evolved, and I trace our evolution back all the way to 20 million years, and everything is in the exact lineal sequence that is most accurate to what we know about history right now. And this document is constantly being amended, and it's enormous.
Well, since your
history, but I found out
that's good.
A lot of these UFO cases cluster around each other, Brooks.
Yeah.
When you have some really famous good UFO cases, some of the researchers forgot to take a look at the time and dates that they occurred and find out what else was going on at the same time.
Right.
And the amazing thing was, most of the best UFO cases of the 20th century all cluster around each other, which gives you a pattern. Like, you know how when you got a bunch of Navy ships and you send them to someplace in the Indian Ocean, and then they land a bunch of Marines on those islands and they have a whole lot of overflights and everything? That's called an expeditionary force.
Right.
And I believe that UFOs deploy their UFO mother ships deploy their assets, you know, to our world in the way that we deploy assets to the Persian Gulf and to Iraq and to Afghanistan.
So they're not just space tourists. They're coming here with purpose, and they're coming here to do things or recover things.
Exactly. There's so much dimension to my UFO research, because my reports of investigation and my conclusions aren't just written as prose. I illustrate what people tell me. And I illustrate with my timeline the relationships that different cases have to each other. For instance, a lot of people thought that the UFO landing at Holloman Air Force Base in 1964, April of 64, was completely bogus. It was a rumor. There was no evidence that ever happened. But when you look at the date, it happened within 12 hours of one of the most reliable UFO cases ever in the same location, and that's the Lonnie Zamora case, where a local cop from Socorro, New Mexico, observes a UFO landing in the desert and taking off again with occupants. And
I remember that was an egg-shaped craft that was
exactly
it was
and a ship, day. A ship identical to that was seen in Ohio 12 hours earlier, and then within 12 hours, that was the landing at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico near Holloman.
Kind of
Florida.
Funny if you go back in history to the River Euphrates, there was an egg-shaped ship that landed in that river. A female got out of it, and she named herself Ishtar. And that's where we get our tradition of Easter and why we use an egg.
That's correct. The egg-shaped spaceship, and you have to remember, lenticular disks, egg shapes like alligator egg shapes, egg shapes of any kind, spheres, these are the most engineeringly sound shapes for transmedium propulsion. Now, interestingly enough, a number of abductees, including my wife, have been given visions of Pythagorean symbology, including Platonic solids. Now, you know how people have been cutting crystals and quartz in the shapes of the seven Platonic solids for going on thousands of years, including the dodecahedron,
right,
and the icosahedron or whatever, the cube, the sphere, the trimid-shaped, all of that, which, by the way, my wife, her Platonic solids is the number one thing that she sells, because she was shown those by aliens at Mount Shasta during the 4 days that she met me. And she thought it was a dream at first, but just about everybody we've talked to has told me that she's, they call her starseed and abductee and all this other stuff. And I'm a detective, so I tend to throw those words, you know, out with the bathwater pretty much. But she has been obsessed with these forms, and of course, you know, she has them on the website. And, you know, she's sitting here with me right now. So when you see me digress to this stuff, it's because my wife is like, hey, tell them about this stuff and do it now. But, and so she's sitting here right with me, and you're actually getting an interview with both of us, which is the closest anybody's ever going to get to hearing her on the radio.
If it's any solace to her, I have been through the Flower of Life Merkaba meditation training, and I am wearing a Merkaba thing around my neck as I speak on the radio.
Yeah. So probably you've had similar experiences to what my wife has had. Now, I used to think, remember, I'm a detective. I'm an old-fashioned gumshoe private eye. And I'm a hardcore, hard-nosed, If I don't see it with my own eyes, it's complete garbage. Well, she got a hold of me, and the first thing she showed me was ghosts with my naked eye. Then she showed me what healing practitioners can do, and she used a Reiki modality. I had a pet toad that was dying of old age. She puts it in her hands, and this thing was supposed to die. It was really big. It was really old, and you know how amphibians don't live for very long. She held it in her hands for a few minutes, then she put it back in the terrarium, and it lived for 16 more weeks, totally healthy, and then dropped dead of extreme old age.
Wow.
I had a 75-year-old boa constrictor. The thing was 9 feet long. I used to give it daily baths, you know, let it climb and then drop it in the tub, you know, because it liked to soak in the warm water. And she was terrified of snakes. But one day she comes and she wakes me up and she says, "Your boa constrictor's dead." So I fly out of my bed and I run to the cage and there he is. He's alive and well. So I stick him in the tub and I let him swim. Now, he's in the tub full of, you know, tepid water all day long. 6 o'clock in the afternoon, I go in to check on him. Because boa constrictors are not like babies. You don't have to watch them the entire time. They won't drown. They are water snakes. And he was belly up. He had passed away in that tub, and Lori was only off by about 6 hours.
Wow.
And I took him to the vet. And I asked for a necropsy because I wanted to know what killed my snake because I thought I had taken great care of him. And the vet looks at the snake and he cuts him open. He looks at some of the tissues and some of the intestinal tissues and the cloaca and everything else. And he says, judging from the size of the snake and the condition of its tissues, this thing had to be in excess of 75 years old. Your snake died of old age. So, That was a bit of a shock. So she showed me healing modalities starting with my pet.
Forever.
Then she showed me that UFO abductions were real because I walked into our bedroom one night while we were still in Southern California, and this was in 1996. And she was 3 feet off the bed. It was like a scene from The Exorcist. 3 feet off the bed, just floating there. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I get down in the bed and I go to sleep. I found out later that that is an exact modality of UFO abduction described by hundreds of people all over the world. When you walk into your bedroom and your wife is hovering 3 feet off the bed and she's within inches of the ceiling and you just go, okay, I'm tired, I'm going to sleep. That is a major abduction sequence ongoing.
Wow.
So here I am, a hardcore, hard-nosed detective, had put a lot of people in jail, and there are people still in prison 20 years later for some of the cases that I worked. And my wife is floating 3 feet, and I'm like, this is just unbelievable. And you know, the next day I told her, you know, it's just a dream. But it wasn't. Then Lloyd Pye brings the Star Child skulls over to my house.
Yeah,
on the last 3 days of April 1999. You know the two Star Child skulls? The one that is a human female with very mannish looks, and the other, a lot of people think it's an alien.
Right, right. I held it in my hand. Well, at least I held the replica in my hands.
Okay, well, I had the real thing in my house because Lloyd gave me 3 days to do, while he was there, mind you. He gave me 3 days to actually do the forensic composites in my sketch pad of the Star Child faces. And I ended up doing five renderings.
Oh, you're the one that drew the face that everybody sees.
Well, no. I did the best face and the most real face. But Lloyd didn't like it because it wasn't an alien face. My assessment was that a profound mutation had occurred in an Aztec child that gave its bone the cross section more similar to a bird, and that it was a mutation like what you would expect if you were to move human children and have them reproduce for several generations in a microgravity environment such as a space station.
I see.
So the neck attachment points where the muscles plug into the back of the skull in order to support the weight of the head on the shoulders were severely reduced. This was not a pathology. It was a mutation, because we were dealing with something that was profoundly changed from the normal parent population.
Well, sure,
and I believe that what
environment.
What I believed I was looking at was a 100% human child who, for whatever reason, belonged to a group of these kids from Central and South America who, for thousands of years, were born evoking the physiology needed to live in zero-G more comfortably.
Right.
Larger heads, reduced body mass, with a reduction in the muscle support structures. And this kid could not live. This kid could not live under any circumstances without a neck brace, because his neck would not have been supported in normal Earth gravity, and he would have suffocated himself, either in his sleep or while playing. Now, my wife had a vision of how he survived for the 6 years that he survived. And she even told this to Lloyd. She says that the Native Americans, who were descendants of the people from the Phoenix Valley who moved to Mexico City, they took creosote and chaparral, and they wove a flexible neck brace, which was then covered inside and out with rabbit fur. And so that the kid had a cervical collar of sorts for his entire life. And this child was a human child. There's no alien DNA in it whatsoever. And it's a boy because the Y chromosome was found at the degraded but still intact amelogenin locus during the fragment of the DNA sample that was pulled from inside the tooth that was inside the mandible.
What did you make of the bone density? Just incredibly high.
Well, now, see, that's the number one component to the alien argument. The bone density and the support structures, you know, in other words, the architecture of the interior of the bones are so profoundly bird-like that this thing has to be an alien, because there's no mammalian bone structure even remotely close to it. And that's the truth. The problem is that a microgravity environment, if you're breeding artificially for a microgravity environment, that kind of a bone structure, extra strong but extra lightweight, totally makes sense from, you know, an artificial engineering point of view. So I told Lloyd, this is a human child. There's no evidence, obviously, of any DNA that is anomalous to humans. On the other hand, what if this kid was part of a breeding population or a series of experiments that had been conducted 900 years ago to produce a race of humans that could live in a microgravity environment, such as maybe the asteroid belt or Europa or, you know, something like that? Maybe they needed them to mine asteroids, and so they needed them comfortable in a microgravity environment. This might have been another version of experimentation that succeeded or failed that led to the hybridization type stuff that we've seen over the last 30 years. Because
if it was a hybrid, then it wouldn't be 100% human.
I don't believe it's a hybrid. I think that hybridization experiments have probably only been going on for the past few centuries. But that 900 years ago, they were doing selective breeding to try to create human beings that were ideal for a microgravity environment. That's just, you know, my personal opinion. And remember, this is just me speculating wildly. The fact is that the bone architecture of the star child is totally anomalous. And the closest thing to the interior architecture of star child's bones is that what you find in songbirds, you know, small finches, chickadees, that sort of thing.
Right.
So
bones that are strong but light enough for
right. Them. Now, this is clearly a biological structure of biological origin. It's not fake. It's totally real. The configuration of the skull, the reduction of the neck attachment points, nobody can argue that. you know, around where the medulla oblongata and the spine plugs into the base of the skull. There's no way. There's no way. The reduced neck attachment points on the occipital portions of the skull. There's no way that you can deny that. So I'm playing with, you know, the idea of somebody monkeying with either an artificially created or natural series of mutations based on the concept that either Mother Nature or a higher order species is trying to get elements of our population ready for microgravity. And that
well,
for whatever reason...
that I found to really be anomalous about that skull was that the eye sockets were so shallow and the hole that was available for the optic nerve was way down in the cheekbones instead of up in the lower forehead where it normally is.
Precisely, but that creates a form of panoramic vision unlike any of the binocular visions that normal human hunters have experienced. This is a thing that can see in panavision, you know, like those old widescreen movies.
Yeah, great peripheral vision.
Absolutely, which there are some environments, perhaps out in space, where that might be an advantage. You have to remember something else. All these descriptions of aliens with enormous large eyes suggest one thing more profoundly than anything else. If these aliens are real and not the figment of somebody's imagination, Brooks, then they have to be in an artificial environment where there are no sharp edges. There's a reason why human beings and most animals that are not, you know, something other than vertebrates. There's a reason why all vertebrate animals basically have two eyes and the eyes are tiny compared to the overall body mass. And the bigger the animal, the smaller the eye orbit is in proportion to the total body mass of the animal. There's a reason for that. And that's because there's twigs and rocks and sharp edges throughout all of nature, not to mention the teeth of your adversary. And it's very easy to lose an eye in nature. And once you've lost one eye, you no longer have stereo vision. You no longer have binocular vision. One-eyed people have an extreme disadvantage compared to everybody else. So eyes are a precious commodity. Therefore, they're very, very small in comparison to the overall size of the body. So when you see these aliens with these enormous eyes and everything, obviously they're living in an artificial structure in a microgravity environment with no sharp edges so that they don't have to worry about having their eyes poked out.
Right, exactly. Well, listen, we're going to come back after about a six-minute break, and your phone is live through the break, so if you yell at the dog, it's going to come out over the radio. This is
well, I might be yelling at the kids, but I will not be yelling at the dog.
All right, we'll be back. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio. Know you have existed for many thousands of years. The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning series from Sandy Andrews. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrews at X Squared Radio and order the book today. There is something about to happen to the Earth. You know it. You can feel it. Well, the creators of the Kill Shot have collected the evidence for you in a stunning new documentary called The Horizon Project. The first DVD is now in print, and you can get it by clicking on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio.
Believe me when I tell you, this may be the most important video production you will ever see. This is destined to air on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel, but you need the uncut version. Click the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio and get your copy today. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two of the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. And welcome back, my dear friends, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In the news lately has been the story of a galactic wave that is about to reach Earth. Some say that it reached Earth in December and went around us, or was redirected around us by an alien craft who stood in the way and created a power shield of some kind. We never knew it, and yet we have benefited from their work. Even more say that it is due to arrive on March 9th. They call it Slam Day. The power of this wave is predicted by whistleblowers in the European Space Agency, allegedly, to be able to deliver 300-mile-an-hour winds, earthquakes, volcanoes, and even ocean upheavals. Called the Galactic Tsunami, officials are publicly denying reports. They have been bouncing signals off of it for months. They have been privately moving assets, digging massive tunnels, and
conducting maneuvers with troops and ships that are not strategic in nature. Now, we don't want to, we bring this news to you not to be an alarmist, but to keep you informed with the reports that are out there. You know, we constantly monitor the solar wind here at X Squared Radio. Each week we report the wind, sunspots, and even geomagnetic activity here on Earth. And right now there are no signs that I know of that this or any more is anything more than a prank of some kind by someone claiming to work for the European Space Agency. Let's use a little bit of physics sense, folks. The only ability that we have to sense anything is with a speed of light signal that we might send out in space, bounce off something, receive it back to a satellite some 23,000 miles out in space, which would relay it back here to us at Earth. The fastest thing that we have is the speed of light. Gravitational waves travel between 200 and 20,000 times the speed of light. The speed of gravity from the Sun to the Earth has been measured several times. It is recorded at over 20,000 times the speed of light, almost instantaneous for one solar unit. So claims out there that there is some kind of galactic wave that's going to arrive on March 9th are physically, in the opinion of this physicist, bogus. Don't go out and buy yourself a shelter or stock up on food or move away from the coast based on these reports. In my opinion, that report that's circulating around the internet now of a tsunami, a galactic tsunami, is bogus. But that does not mean that you should not always have some kind of emergency preparedness supplies around. I will investigate this week and try to get my friends in the industry to come on the program and tell the truth about this event. Keep checking the archives because I will post the interview the hour it is completed, whether it is live on this station or not. I promise you, I will find out the truth and I will report it to you. If you feel anything is amiss or that you should heed any of these warnings, do so in an organized manner. You know we have provided for you the resources to gather anything relative to emergency supplies you might need, from food to radios to shelters, any of that stuff, but don't rush out and buy anything based on a March 9th date. I have no desire to take advantage of this in any way. We are here to help you. So call or write as often as you like. A few of you have written about this galactic tsunami, and that's why I have brought it up. The response that we've had about the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition has been overwhelming. I had no idea so many of you out there have had such strong feelings about the possibility. And that has been a little humbling to me. The very best that I can do is to tell you thank you for all of the mail that you've been sending. I have been overwhelmed by it. Our first calculations are for this documentary that we're going to be putting together, that there will be somewhere around 1,000 hours of video and film taken during the upcoming expedition. The very best of that will be digested and directed into a feature-length documentary that will be shared with everyone who wants to see it. We don't know if the cable channels will grant us a single minute of airtime for it, but if that is the case, then we will tour the country with it and show it to everyone. You'll be able to buy it in DVD form. If we raise enough money and the conditions of space and Earth allow it, we'll do it again and try to take even more of you with us. We may be opening a window predicted to come forth for thousands of years by numerous civilizations, not the least of which were biblical and even modern prophets. But if you really want to get the flavor of it, the 20-minute pitch video is now for sale on the website at phoenixsciencefoundation.org and also at X Squared Radio. And we are launching a brand new online store engine that will make it even easier to help you with your purchases. One more thing. And then I'm going to announce the phone lines, and I think we already have a caller on the line, so just hang on one second. You know that our friends down at Phoenix Science Foundation are also involved in bringing new energy devices to the consumer level. Well, we have been met with some stiff opposition in some corners, but not enough to stop us from doing what we came here to do.
there are organizations out there whose purpose is to monopolize the energy market, even the new energy market. We don't believe in that. We don't have enough time for that. If you feel you would like to help in any way, you can always reach us at phoenixsciencefoundation.org. The more you do, the sooner you will see clean, renewable energy at your local town and supply store. You already pay taxes. If you feel that is all you have to do, and you believe the oil companies will take care of all your energy needs without pollution, then do nothing more than you're doing right now. All I can say is dishonesty comes with its own karma. We're going to make a change in the way electricity is made. We're going to make it possible to stop burning the planet, to heat our homes or cook our meals or drive our cars or fly our planes. We can do it in 10 years, or we can do it in 1 year. The choice is yours. See what you can do, Earth Explorers. Our potential is absolutely unlimited. And listen, the phone lines are going to open up, 877-876-5227, anywhere inside the United States. 888-810-8322, toll-free anywhere in Canada, and anywhere on planet, off planet, or inside the planet. If you can reach a phone tower, you can get through on this number, 530-876-3222. Before I get back to my guest, Bill McDonald, let's go ahead and take this call. Caller, where are you calling from, and what's your first name?
Yes, this is Heather in New Mexico.
Hi, Heather. How are you?
Pretty good. Is your guest still on the air? On the.
Yes, I think Bill McDonald is still with us, right, Bill?
I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, we can hear you fine. Go ahead.
Oh, well, hello, Heather.
Hi, Bill. I have a question for you. When I was a very young child, I had a number of abductions, which terrified me as a child. And what I remember is being submerged in a vat of fluids. And, of course, I came back alive. But I just got the very end of when you were talking about the Navy SEALs being subjected to some kind of a fluids that they had to breathe. I wonder.
Well, Heather, you're not the only one. I have 248 legitimate, as far as I've been able to ascertain, experiencers / abductees / contactees, and more than 50 of them have claimed to have been immersed in either a viscous fluid or a gel,
uh-huh,
where they were allowed to breathe anyway. And apparently, these were probably people that were going to be taken for a very long distance voyage, but for whatever reason, they were returned. It has been surmised and it has been envisioned by a lot of very famous sci-fi and scientific visual futurists and theorists that long-distance space voyages would involve some kind of hibernation, and that encasing an individual in some kind of fluid, perhaps one that has an infusion of tetrodotoxin, properly refined, of course, as an anesthesia and a preservative, would be with the ideal salinity and everything, would be the ideal for the storage of that person for the long-distance space voyages. So it came as no surprise when over 50 of my abductees claimed to have been immersed in a fluid. You know, in movies like Star Wars and everything like that, when your hero is badly hurt and is in intensive care, they seem to have been immersed in some kind of vat of fluid. Star Wars, Starship Troopers, probably a half a dozen different movies where they were encased in some sort of fluid. So it's of no surprise, because it isn't just, you know, a wild guess. There's a lot of people who have envisioned that the storage of a human being for long-distance travel would require immersion in some kind of a fluid. And it would have to be something that functioned like an amniotic broth.
Oh,
so you're not alone, Heather.
I'd sure like to know where I went.
I'd like to know where you went, too. Heather, please contact me by using any of the email buttons at alienufoart.com. I'd like to hear more about this.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, both of you. Appreciate the
Thank show. You very much for the phone call, Heather.
Thank you.
Okay, Brooks.
Yes.
One of the most gorgeous women on the planet is sitting here. And
yeah,
she's
pointing, hi, Lori.
Yeah. She's trying to point out Lemurian seed crystals. She wants people to know that if they're into meditation or higher levels of personal self-focus, that these seed crystal wands that she got from some mine down in a really remote part of Brazil or near the Brazil-Venezuela border might help people with their ability to focus when they're doing their meditations. So she has asked me to point out these Lemurian seed crystal wands, which I've now done. Lori wants everybody to know that today, if they email her that they heard us on Brooks Agnew's Sunday radio show, X Factor, that she will knock $10 off of the, I guess that would be the shipping and handling. She's going to knock $10 off the final price for anybody that contacts her for anything because of today.
No, I got you. So anybody that hears this on X Squared Radio, even on the archives, make sure to make mention of that in your email, and you'll get a discount at alienufoart.com. Let me ask you a
now,
question.
Now, alienufoart.com has also let Brooks know that, you know, we're very much interested on that sea voyage up to the Canadian Arctic. On the icebreaker.
Right, we're going to talk about that North Pole Inner Earth expedition here.
Absolutely, because if Brooks goes into an area where there is electromagnetic flux associated with some kind of portal phenomena, like what happened at the Sherman Ranch that's owned by Bob Bigelow in eastern Utah, and some of
right.
the listeners may be familiar with that ranch that was investigated by the National Institute of Discovery Sciences, of which I had a consulting relationship at the time, then they'll know that some of Brooks's electronic equipment might fail if he actually enters within the event horizon of one of those portals. So
yeah,
the reason I would
be
going...
analog equipment too. We're going to take regular film
yeah.
cameras and regular
right.
You know, witnesses and artists and things like that so that we
exactly.
can
Exactly. That's why you have artists. Because if the electronic equipment fails, your artists can still render any effects that were seen.
Can you bring us up to date? You mentioned an event, the Sherman Ranch. Can you bring us up to date what that was?
Okay, for folks who are not familiar with the Sherman Ranch, the Sherman family, a.k.a. the Gorman family, purchased a ranch outside of Fort Duchesne, Utah, in 1994, with about 80 head of cattle, and they were going to make a go of it. And people in town seemed real friendly, and the land was surrounded on almost all sides by parcels of land associated with the Ute Indian Reservation. And the geology is it's part of the Marsden Formation, Dinosaur National Monument, which is on the Colorado side of the border, is less than 50 miles, literally, from the ranch. And in the center of the ranch, there is a limestone ridge. And the Indians call it Skinwalker Ridge. And it's been called Skinwalker Ridge by the Navajos and the Utes going back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And Skinwalker Ridge, a.k.a. the Sherman Ranch, a.k.a. the Gorman Ranch, a.k.a. the ranch now owned by Bob Bigelow, has been exhibiting very bizarre phenomena in the electromagnetic range and the appearance of animals prehistoric in nature that have been extinct for 1.8 million years ago, 800,000 years ago, or animals that have gone extinct within the last 8,000 years. We're talking animals that are a type of dog, in other words, a canid, that has the appearance of a bull mastiff with tiger stripes, but it's the size of a Clydesdale horse.
Oh,
that corresponds with a species of animal called Procyon, which was a prehistoric canid that predated wolves, because wolves have only been around for 800,000 years. An extinct species of wolf, the size of a small racehorse, called the dire wolf has also been seen on the ranch, along with a bunch of Bigfoots and a bunch of UFO phenomena. And the UFO phenomena got real crazy on the same nights that the Phoenix Light formations were ongoing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles south in Phoenix, Arizona. So portal phenomena is something that was researched by Louis L'Amour, the famous Western story writer. Him and Zane Grey are the two most famous Western novelists in history.
Yeah, I didn't know Louis L'Amour about portals, though.
Well, there's the second to last book he ever wrote in 1980 was called The Haunted Mesa. And it dealt with portal phenomena and crossing over through these holes in rocks to Xibalba, which is like, if you notice, the Native Americans of the region, they have the first world, the second world, the third world, which we currently reside in, and the fourth world. And Xibalba is like the second world. And apparently some of the Anasazi disappeared into that after they were pressured by the predation of the Utes, the Paiutes, the Navajo, and the Apaches, which basically drove their civilization, which was weakened by drought, to near extinction.
So the predators drove them away.
Right. Well, you know, those were reaver cultures. They were raiders. They stole their women, and they stole their animals, and they stole their crops. And then they were hit by droughts, and they had to retreat. And apparently, some of them retreated into these portals. Now, a bunch of physicists and NASA-accredited scientists set up a bunch of magnetometers, a bunch of video cameras, a bunch of ultraviolet, a bunch of infrared, all kinds of sensors, detectors, and recorders, and they actually observed doorways opening in midair at night, and these very strange creatures, including humanoids and eel-like things, crawling or flopping out and then disappearing into the surrounding landscape. And they observed something that was like a reptilian alien or a dinosaur, at least 12 foot high, staring at them from the cottonwoods. And these prehistoric animals, no matter how many times they get shot at by the, you know, Tom Gorman, a.k.a. Mr. Sherman, who was a world-class hunter, you know, with very large caliber rifles, yet they never found blood. They shot this dog-like thing that was like a dire wolf in the head several times, and they even blew a chunk of its fur and flesh, you know, clean out of it, yet it didn't bleed. I mean, it's just really, really strange and bizarre phenomena. This thing had a horse's face in its mouth. Huh?
What would you attribute that to? How would you...
We're dealing with portal phenomena to another world where the laws of nature and physics obviously operate in a different way, which is why I told you that it might be possible for a hollow Earth to exist or coexist in the same time and space as a normal Earth that, you know, is mighty solid on its liquid mantle and inner core, and that it wouldn't mean that anybody was wrong, because under certain electromagnetic conditions, and when the relationship between Earth and the Sun, the Earth's magnetic field in itself, and all conditions are met, possibly timed to the cycles of, you know, the solar storms, these electromagnetic portals, these geomagnetic portals open up, and all of a sudden you have access to other worlds that intersect in other dimensions. And you actually have a corridor between those worlds accessed by the kivas of these ancient Native Americans and by these funny caves in the Four Corners regions and a lot of this.
Where are the creatures that were shot now? I mean, did they hurt?
Well, they disappeared. They ran off. They didn't die. There are no carcasses.
Somewhere on the Earth in the third dimension, but we don't know where.
Well, it would be considered a fourth or a fifth dimension, actually, and it wouldn't even be that. It would be another three dimensions, probably affected by time, which is the fourth dimension, intersected but skewed in such a way that we can't perceive it unless we enter these portals. And you as a physicist understand all of this a lot better than
sure,
I do.
Sure. But I guess I'm asking, did the animals go back into the portal? Or did they
obviously,
run
they had
somewhere?
To, because in all cases they disappeared. And obviously they knew their way back home. You know, when an injured animal is injured, it crawls home to die.
I got you.
So That's probably what happened. Most animals, with the exception of cats, crawl home to die. If a dog gets hit by a car, he'll die underneath the front porch. He doesn't want to die in the street, and he doesn't want to die on strange land. He crawls home and does his dying at the doorstep. And so, you know, these prehistoric canids are probably the same way. And, you know, these giant lizards that are a lot like Komodo dragon lizards that were described by Navajo and Ute peoples to Louis L'Amour. Now, as you know, those are only found in Indonesia, and the largest species of them are now extinct. They were part of the megafauna that went extinct around 8 or 6,000 BC. Megalania prisca is the one that comes to mind. That's a 30-foot lizard that could have gobbled an entire family without any problem whatsoever. Ambush predators, like the Komodo dragon, only 10 times bigger. Well, what ends up happening is they're turning up in these portals, these giant varanid monitor lizards. Genus Varanus is the genus that monitor lizards have come from, and varanids are the family of lizards, and their closest living relatives, believe it or not, are the ancient mosasaurs and tylosaurs, which were the ocean dragons from Cretaceous era, 65 million years ago, going back to 200 million years ago.
Is this why you can draw dragons so well? As you have?
Oh, absolutely. I have an affinity for dragons because I understand the physiology of pterosaurs, the physiology of mammalian bats. I've had them as pets. The physiology of, birds themselves, which are direct descendants of theropod dinosaurs. And I understand all aspects of the anatomy of the shoulder of birds, pterosaurs, and bats that allows them to fly. And dragons and large monitor lizards, I've had monitor lizards as pets years and years and years ago when I was a kid. I'm not going to get too specific about this, but let's just say it was some certain species of monitor lizards from the South Pacific and Indonesia.
Let me ask you, I had
their babies as pets, and then, of course, I sold them to private breeders when they got too big to manage.
Let me ask you a question. Now that we know that this portal exists on the Sherman Ranch, is there any kind of monitoring that goes on, or are there any efforts to try to go through?
Oh, absolutely. Now, this is strictly controlled by Robert Bigelow and Bigelow Aerospace, and it used to be strictly controlled by Robert Bigelow and NIDS, which is the organization that he had to kill off in order to focus on launching inflatable hotel-like structures in the nose cones of Russian ICBM rockets in the low Earth orbit.
And they've been successful. They were successful.
Very successful. The second launch is coming up in just a few weeks.
Right. So now that's a successful high-tech company doing really neat stuff with high-volume inflatable spacecraft.
Absolutely. But Bob Bigelow, in order to get permission from the United States government to use Russian and Chinese boosters, he had to give back something in return, which means he had to kill off NIDS. Nobody liked the level of science that was being accomplished with NIDS or the freedom of publication that the individual researchers were allowed. So that's another story for another day. But the monitoring of the ranch continues, and it's very, very secretive. And, you know, Bob doesn't want to get embroiled in anything that's going to give him a problem with the permissions that he has to use Russian missiles to launch his products and services into orbit. So, and you know, he's made his money off the Las Vegas hotel industry. After Steve Wynn, Bob Bigelow is the second most richest man in Las Vegas, at least by my understanding.
I can see why.
And, you know, I'd be doing the exact same thing if I was Bigelow and I had his money. I'd be doing the same kind of science. It would be my hobby. I would have a NIDS, and I'd have a Bigelow Aerospace of my very own, and I would have attempted to purchase Mir and turn it into a space hotel until I found out how filthy and contaminated it was on the inside, which is why they eventually let it go, because fungus was rampant on the inside of some of the modules by the time the Russians moved out of it. And it really did need to be burned up.
You can't get it out.
Well, you know how if you've ever been in the locker room of a school that's 40 to 60 years old, there are certain smells that are so embedded in the walls and the structures that it will never, ever clear out.
Yeah.
And that's how it is in most space stations. when you're in those canisters for a while, you get used to the smell. You don't even notice it. But when the new people show up, and you know, successive generations of astronauts and cosmonauts have been living there, the stench is rather profound.
Well, I could tell you, nuclear-powered submarines, when you go in them, you have to put on this kind of a jumpsuit. It's the only thing that really goes through the laundry in the submarine. But at the end of a three-month cruise, those suits are called poopy suits. And
yeah,
they have that name for a reason, because you don't smell it when you're on the sub. But when you come off the sub, believe me, you can definitely smell it.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me ask you a question about the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition coming up. We're talking about portals and we're talking about other dimensions accessing our surface in modern times, the North Pole has with it a lot of, shall we say, metaphysics or mysticism about it. It's not just a land that you sail to or fly over for a shortcut between continents. There appears a sizable mythology about it, that there may be an opening into an inner Earth. And then the nature of that inner Earth is somewhat debatable. Is it actually a hollow Earth, or is it an alternate dimension? And I've spoken to all kinds of people who channel it, who look into it for the remote viewing. But we're going to go there to see for ourselves this fall. But I wanted your opinion of what you think, what your technology tells you about it.
Well, in the four-dimensional space-time that I'm sitting in right here in Phoenix, Arizona, I'm sitting on a particularly stable and thick portion of the crust, which is not volcanically active and has not been volcanically active for 310 million years. This whole area, East Phoenix, is the remnants of a 310-million-year-old caldera, an ancient oozing shield volcano. And the lava here is so old that it's actually now metamorphic rock. It's no longer igneous. And that's what Superstition Mountain is. And that's why you have a lot of copper and a little bit of gold and a bunch of cinnabar and a little bit of silver that's, you know, been mined and can still be mined in the Superstition Mountains. Those ancient metals are there from, you know, Permian times. But underneath all of that is definitely a high-pressure, high-temperature mantle of thick, viscous magma fluid, followed by a supercritical, superheated inner core fluid with different densities and properties, including electrical. And in the center of that is a hypersolid confluence of uranium and iron, which is the inner core. And it spins because the outer core is like it's like the transmission fluid inside of a vehicle's transmission bell.
Right.
And the inner core is a nuclear reactor. And it generates a lot of heat that keeps and a lot of pressure that keeps a lot of the active geological processes going, because it isn't just the sun that provides the Earth its energy for its biological cycles in order to function. A lot of the energy is coming from inside the Earth. Mars had a smaller inner system that operated for the first 1.5 to 2 billion years of its existence. And Mars probably evolved life before Earth did, but then its core ceased to spin, its magnetic fields diminished, and the planet died while life was still, you know, at the stage of sea urchins and shelled mollusks. And,
sure, you had germicidal wavelengths of UV light coming in from the sun, and they were not routed around the planet by a magnetic.
Right. Well, that doesn't happen all at once. The spin slows down incrementally. The magnetic fields decrease incrementally. The life evolves to withstand the UV incrementally for a while, but eventually the amount of UV overcomes the ability of the cells to reproduce, even protected.
Oh, yeah. It dimerizes organic molecules, and then they...
Exactly. But that happens over a 500 million years. It probably took 300 to 500 million years for all life, except possibly for certain kinds of extremophile bacteria and viruses, which might still be alive in the Martian soil in extremely salt water conditions in extreme cold. But other than that, and perhaps certain kinds of lichen embedded in layers of rock could exist, you know, in the lowest altitude areas, such as the bottom of the Valles Marineris on Mars. Other than that, 300 to 500 million years after the core started to slow down, life ceased to evolve and then went extinct on Mars. And probably 100 million years before life evolved on Earth, life was already evolving on Mars, because the smaller the planet and the further out it is, the sooner life evolves, but also the sooner life goes extinct.
Sure.
So,
Venus... It's actually known, too, that all planets in our solar system emit more energy than they receive from the sun. So they do have some inner source of energy, but I am a little doubtful that there is a nuclear reactor going on inside our planet, because under those kinds of pressures it would reach supercriticality and explode.
Not at all. There's a balance between the weight of everything, you know, compressing down on the core, and the amount of heat generated by the core. So a situation of balance exists, which then allows for the cycle to continue for multiple billions of years longer than it did on Mars. And with Venus, the same thing's going on, except that there was a runaway greenhouse effect on Venus, which was closer to the sun, and that made it uninhabitable to organic life, which is kind of a postscript.
The radioactive species that make it to the surface of our planet, and they're very small particles, some of them are radon, these are nuclides of uranium, which do not seem to belie the theory that there is a fission going on in the inner core.
Okay, so you don't feel that there's low-grade fission in the inner core. Other scientists feel that there is.
I think there's decay going on, but I don't think that fission occurs. It has occurred on this planet, but I don't think naturally.
Okay, well, you know, and that's where a lot of people agree to disagree. But the point is, there's solid mass and density below our feet going all the way through. With the Hollow Earth situation, in another universe where the laws are slightly different and where accretion occurs in different ways, and accretion is where small particles of dust and dirt and debris and star stuff accumulates together in order to form balls in gas, and eventually the orbit of these balls sucks more of the gas down onto the surface and more, and these particles accrete, as in crush together and become solid mass. That's called accretion. In a world where accretion is different, perhaps natural planetary bodies could form the model of a Dyson sphere. I believe that the only way to have a Dyson sphere, which is a hollow world in this universe, is for it to be constructed artificially. And the Earth is clearly not an artificial construction. But it's quite possible that the Earth and all of its sister planets, larger ones especially, could have analogs in another universe that are hollow and that have small mini-suns, you know, at the core rather than the kind of solid structure of iron and uranium that a lot of the rocky worlds do in this universe, and that life could have evolved or transferred there through the portals. And it may be just that life from this universe transferred through the portals, like the trans-dimensional or sliding version of panspermia. And so you have exotic species in these niche environments, these bubble universes, if you will, that would allow for the concept of a hollow Earth or a hollow world to exist. There's just no evidence in this four-dimensional space-time for it to exist. And yet, at the North Pole and at the South Pole, you occasionally find fresh cuttings of tropical plants in warm water currents that have suddenly appeared out of nowhere just off of the ice shelves and just off of, you know, the ice flows in the north.
And you find things like bee pollen and flower petals.
Exactly.
And you find butterflies, and you find seagulls that only exist in the warm
weather
and don't migrate south.
If a portal opens up underwater and something transfers from one universe to the other, from the seawater in one universe to the seawater in the other, or if, you know, there is portals in the air, pollen can transfer, all of these subtle suggestions of something more up there than meets the eye. These lost worlds, these lost continents, these Irwin, Allen, Edgar Rice Burroughs versions of lost worlds under the ice and everything could very well exist. Now, in the Antarctica that normally exists in our four-dimensional space-time, you have these submerged lakes with complex colonies of bacteria that are approximately 17 million years old and have not been exposed to the outside environment in any way, shape, or form for 17 million years. Will they be pathogenic to us when the ice cap melts? Will they be pathogenic if somebody takes a sample and somehow it spills?
Well,
who knows?
The Russians are drilling into that right now, and they've stopped short of it just for that reason.
Scares the crap out of me, the idea that some of these bacteria have been evolving for 17 million years in the ice cap without any exposure to the outside world and without us being able to develop any immunities to whatever those natural mutations have occurred. That's scary stuff, because you could have algae that kills people.
Well,
you
can have algae
saying?
That eats up all the other algae in the ocean.
God only knows.
Fish and stops the
God
ice.
Only knows. Now, that is scary enough as it is.
Sure.
But when we travel to the North Pole, and we're not actually going to the North Pole, we're going to be north of Ellesmere Island and Prince Patrick Island and the Canadian Arctic Islands inside the Arctic Circle. We're going to be looking primarily for electromagnetic phenomena and physical evidence of things crossing portals. And we're going to be looking to gather anecdotal or actual recorded evidence of phenomena occurring, which is either intelligently controlled or of natural origin related to these portals.
Right.
And it's going to be like the Sherman Ranch, but on a much bigger scale.
We'll have enough detection equipment with us to determine if what we witness is artificial or natural. And in 13 days or 14 days, we're not going to have the wherewithal to make a full determination. But if we gather data that does conflict with the current Earth is solid all the way through theory, we're not going to throw it out. We're going to put it out in the community and let the scientists that are familiar with the structure of the Earth, analyze it and see if they can refute it. If it creates more questions, then we mount another expedition and we go back and we measure again. That's how science is done.
Well, you're going to be doing science on this expedition, and I'm all for it because that's my primary goal as well. But you're going to be doing something else. You're going to be running classes, and you're going to be teaching people to meditate and do higher consciousness. I'm going to be bringing a little grab bag with me. You know, like that doctor bag that Otter had in the old movie Animal House?
Yeah.
And in it are going to be some of my wife's chakra crystals and some of my wife's scrying globes. You know, those globes where they're solid, quartz, and you use those to help you focus. I'm going to be using some of her chakra crystals and some of her scrying globes to get myself into a mode, because I'm going to attempt to remote view at a particular vector from the ship's course at different places, looking to see if, you know, with the remote viewing that I've practiced and the remote viewing that my wife has practiced, I'm going to look and see ahead if I can anticipate the location of a portal, which I can then convey to you, the expedition leader, and get the ship to change course and head toward it. You see what I'm saying?
Yes,
we're going to try remote viewing and ranging outward, looking for the location of the phenomena, not just inviting the phenomena to come to us.
Well,
see what I'm saying?
We'll do both, because if there is a phenomenon out there, and it's conscious, and it's aware of our ability to change our consciousness, then it may express its intention, and we want to leave that open. It's a term. It's a condition of the experiment. When we designed this experiment to prove or disprove this hypothesis, we had several factors that were very complicated, and some of them have not been measured in an intentional way before. So we're going to build this experiment according to those people who have drawn up the guidelines for those specific factors, and we're going to try to measure them fair and square and see what we get.
Absolutely. We're going to match science with spirituality, and you're going to have people with their medicine pouches, and people like me with, you know, some of these crystals, which I happen to use as a focus to help me to get into that state where I can lobe out my consciousness in a particular direction or vector, which is what remote viewing is. And, you know, it's going to be a combination of metaphysical and direct physics scientific method done concurrently on the same boat. Now, I want to caution you about a couple of things while we're at it. And
All right.
I can see my wife is adding a bunch of Lemurian seed crystals, and she has her mirror site on eBay. Anybody goes to alienufoart.com and clicks on any of my photo images or any of my wife's highlighted stuff on the right-hand side of the site map, goes to those pages, and also goes by clicking again, you can go straight to the mirror site on eBay, where she has a bunch of stuff on sale right now for folks that want to pick any of that stuff up. She's got those Moldavite angel holders. Those are a big deal for her right now. And also a bunch of angels made of different kinds of exotic stone, amethyst and rose quartz and quartz and a number of different things, and also some stuff that was carved in China. It's absolutely gorgeous.
I picked up some really nice-looking moonstones.
And these alien heads. She's got some alien heads. Now, these aren't alien skulls. These are alien heads, literally identical to some of the aliens that my witnesses described. And she also has some alien skulls that are literally the skulls prognosticated from aliens with the exaggerated eye orbits and what looks like a more pronounced bifurcation of the brain. It would suggest the skull of a gray alien, or perhaps an alien-human hybrid.
What's the caution that you want to give me?
A caution regarding those?
You were going to give me a precautionary measure relative to the expedition before you...
The precautionary measure according to the expedition, and this is business. You're trying to get a number of corporations to sponsor the expedition. Those corporations that you have approached are corporations that produce very well-known products that are sold in, you know, every major grocery store and drugstore and department store, you know, throughout the world. And, you know, you've given me the names of some of them. I'm not going to repeat them on the air.
Right.
But when you pitch those corporations, and when any of us that are going on the expedition with you talk about this stuff in the presence of the sponsors, the expedition needs to be financed as an expedition looking for immediate evidence of climate change in the Arctic, because that's what we're going to be finding on a daily basis while we're there. Meanwhile,
those of us who are in the know, as a scientific expedition only, but I felt that those 100 people, including 33 scientists, that get on that boat, when it leaves port, then we reveal the mission of what we are going to try to do while they're on the ship. I felt
right,
that it was,
but we don't want to upset the sponsors. What we want to do is do the science and record all of the obvious evidence of climate change when we're out there.
They don't need to be sponsors. If they can't go with the true mission of what we're going to do and bring back and share with people, then they don't need to sponsor us. This is
well,
not
nobody's going to sponsor a mission where our primary goal is to find a portal to another version of a parallel Earth's core. But they will sponsor a mission which is going to be photographing direct evidence of climate change, which we're going to see during every day. So we don't have to get, you know, all loud about the fact that we're looking for portals, like on the Sherman Ranch. We keep that to ourselves. That is at no extra cost inherently built into the mission. We sell the mission as climate change, documentation of climate change in an extreme situation. Because let me tell you what we're going to find. We're going to find polar bears hundreds of miles out in the open ocean that are ready to drown. And they're probably going to drown while we watch them. Because the ice melted, they went out too far, they're tired, and even though they got all that blubber and all that oil in their fur, they're cold, they're exhausted, and they're just going to drown. And we're going to capture that. Because that never used to happen. There was always ice floes for them to crawl out on and rest. Not anymore. We're going to be seeing species of birds further north than we've ever seen them before, ever. Far later in the year than we have ever seen before, ever. We're going to see changes in behavior, species of seals that used to be passive becoming far more aggressive. Because they're reacting to changes in their environment. So they're going to be far more aggressive and dangerous to us and our divers than they ever were in decades past. In other words, we're going to be seeing harp seals with the temperament of a leopard seal. You see what I'm saying?
Your idea.
We're going to be recording this stuff, and it's going to be shocking. And that's what the sponsors are going to be associating themselves with. They finance the effort to document the changes because we all want to jump on Al Gore's bandwagon and be good little Democrats and really bust our humps to, do something to intervene in the climate change that is occurring, because we have to change the political landscape in order to get the economic landscape to support the kind of expenses that change is going to require.
I'm
a hardcore Republican. I'm halfway facetious when I say we got to be a bunch of good little Democrats. But right now, none of my Republican buddies are doing a damn thing for climate change. And climate change is here. It's happening. It's happening right here in our country. The tornadoes are stronger. More people are getting killed than ever before. The hurricanes are destroying wider swaths of land, and more people are out. And our economy is taking far greater hits than ever before. So climate change is what we're up there to document on the world's largest civilian icebreaker. But if we get UFOs, if we get portals, if we get things crawling out of the ocean that have never been seen before, if we get contact with intelligent entities that we have never before been able to identify directly, that is what we call the frosting on the cake.
Yeah, that's what turns it into an ordinary geological or a biological expedition into the greatest geological expedition in the history of the world. No doubt about that. Yes, and I agree with you. And we are trying to build it that way.
In the immortal words of Mark Antony of Rome, gentlemen, this is where history is made.
That's
on
right.
The battlefield, such as Philippi.
We're going to make history.
We're going to make history like you wouldn't believe.
Yes, I agree with that. I agree with that. And that is exactly the fire and the fervor that we need on this expedition. There's no doubt about it, and we're glad.
Now, my lovely wife has just shown me something I've never seen before. People who get relief from headaches due to the smelling oils, she's got them on our website. Enchanted sprays and clearing mists. And, the strong scented, what do you call it? You know, where, with the strong scents, essential oils, that's it. She's got a bunch of those for the folks that are looking for white light protection, for the people that are looking to help clear. I mean, this stuff apparently works as good as holy water. and helps clear out bad energy and bad smells and nasty parts of old houses. And she's got it at alienufoart.com and also at her mirror site on eBay.
And that is, of course, linked at X Squared Radio, which we're going to have to take a break right now, and we will be back in about 6.5 minutes with more of Bill McDonald, and we're going to go places you've never been before. Make sure to check out the websites we're talking about, and you can follow along. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio, and we'll be back. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the space store at X Squared Radio. People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique to give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public lands somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the Earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. Brooks Agnew here with X Squared Radio. If you like wildlife art and would love to add some of the most beautiful replicas to your home or office, you should visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio. They have everything from pandas to fish to eagles to horses in all sizes and price ranges. No matter what animal you love, they have the art for you. So visit Wildlife Gifts at X Squared Radio for that special someone today. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gifts for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late.
because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, my dear Earth Explorers. Your letters are so moving. For the first time since I started this program, I have not been able to keep up with reading them. They are so numerous. I promise you I'll rearrange my evenings to sit down with each of them and read every one. I don't want to miss any of them. Keep them coming, though. I want to say thank you to BJ and to Anne for the absolutely humbling way in which they have described how this program has affected them. I promise to keep going. BBS Radio Network gave me my start, and I will not leave them. I have been asked to add some networks, which I am working on, but if you like the content of BBS Radio, I want you to go to the network page at bbsradio.com and make a donation. So my producer can add more bandwidth. I love hearing from you, and I love even more sharing with you the mysteries of the universe and the earth. When you're here, you're home. My guest is Bill McDonald. You've been with us for the past 2 hours. You may still be pulled over at the side of the road so you don't drive out of the signal. You don't want to miss a single minute, I know. If your radio station hasn't aired the whole 3 hours, let us know. Give us the call letters, and we'll do the rest. So here we go for the final hour. Now, I've got a lot of IMs, instant messages, coming in through AOL, piling up, wanting me to ask Bill a lot of questions. So here goes the first one. Bill, where do you see the UFO genre going in the next 5 years?
Well, for all intents and purposes, and with the exception of something lucky that might happen on an expedition such as ours to the Canadian Arctic, I see it going nowhere. And I see it going nowhere fast. And the number one reason why is that there is no economic incentive whatsoever for disclosure, either by governments, by military entities, or by private corporations that have been tasked with administration of artifacts, relics, and records. In fact, the profit is to be made kind of an upside-down version of Reagan's theory of trickle-down economics. If you want to make money off of the UFO secrecy, then the multinational corporate conglomerate that orbits legitimate governments needs to be at the bottom of an upside-down, at the point of an upside-down pyramid with consumer technology and, you know, chain stores such as Fry's and Best Buy and all of that being at the widest base of that upside-down pyramid. Technology advances every year, and every year people end up having to buy a newer version of their Microsoft Windows, and a newer version of the Ford F-150, and a newer version of whatever product or item. You know, their MP3 players are now obsolete, new technology is coming out faster. I went from videotape to CD to DVD technology, and now all of a sudden there's these new technologies that are coming out, such as being able to watch TV on an MP3 or whatever when I'm at work or in traffic. You know, I can watch the episode of Battlestar Galactic that I missed while I'm sitting in traffic in Phoenix. So the technology is moving so fast, and consumers can barely keep up, and consumption is at the base of an upside-down pyramid with the profits trickling down. Technology and technological improvements are inspired in tiny increments from alien technologies that are controlled by a very small collective of individuals that are in the conspiracy world and in the New Age community we call the Illuminati.
So the technology is here, but are the aliens here? Are there aliens?
They are, but they're the wild cards in the whole thing. You see, we're having enough trouble with the extremist element of a number of organized religions around the world, and it isn't just the Muslims. There are extremist Christians, extremist Jews, extremists of religious philosophies from all over Asia that are killing in the name of God or in the name of their version of God or in the name of their version of a particular philosophy.
Always have been.
And aliens don't figure well in a lot of these people's view of things. So when aliens suddenly appear on the scene, that's only going to further complicate an already complicated picture that's going to result possibly, and according to the RAND Institute and the Brookings Institute and a number of think tanks, it's going to result in a breakdown of authority and culture and the controls that religion and other things put on the behavior of the mob. Mass populations of individuals in given communities.
Brookings Institute is right that global first contact revealing that not only are UFOs and aliens coming here to this planet, but they're coming here on a regular basis, on an open basis, and they're trying to work with us. We're too busy shooting them down or trading out with them what they want in exchange for technology. So this global corporate conglomerate can continue to come out with new technology, replacing old technology, and like a restaurant, turning over tables, bringing in more and more consumers and keep the money flowing. Do you think the Brookings Institute is right that revealing that would break down social mores?
It used to be right, but it's less correct now than it used to be. And the number one reason for that is Star Trek and science fiction intellectual properties and movies and the intellectual properties dealing with alien contact. There have been so many of them that it has desensitized a lot of the secular thinkers throughout the world. The problem
maybe
is
a certain documentary in the fall of 2007.
Perhaps, but here's the problem: the vast majority of people throughout the planet. And I'm not talking just in Western civilization, are not secular thinkers. They are directly beholden to religious philosophy that they were raised in, and they're not going to react well to the situation at all, and they're going to react violently. So there's still extreme concern based on the religious modalities of the majority of the 6.5 billion people alive on the planet right now.
Who's the concern? Is it with the powers that are in power, or is the concern with the aliens?
It's irrelevant. The aliens have us over the barrel. They can literally turn us off with the flick of a button using mass frequencies and high-end spectrum electronics and signals to short-circuit our brains or do whatever. I mean, they can literally drop us to the ground with a field. But that's beside the point. I wrote a treatment that started. That's well over 140 pages now. It's a book treatment called The Oasis Earth Hypothesis that deals exactly with this. And in it, I postulate that multi-species, in other words, multiple species existing in existing factions, are ranching specific apportioned populations of the planet. And those communities and everything have been divided up over the last century. And as you know, that there is some talk about alien factions bickering with each other and, shooting at each other on occasion. Well, that's no different than the cattle barons that used barbed wire to, sew up, range lands across both North America and Australia in the 1800s.
Sure.
In the last two centuries. And the cattle barons would occasionally get into feuds where they'd shoot at each other over who should have which stretch of land or what the water rights and access to resources on those particular lands were. And sometimes the fighting got pretty brutal. Now, if you can update the technology by approximately 10,000 years and forwardly evolve, you know, parallel species by about 1 to 2 million years, you've got the same process but at a higher level. And so the answer is, aliens ranch us the way we ranch cattle. We are an agricultural reproductive commodity. Our DNA helps some factions of gray aliens, which I believe come from Earth's future, and other factions of gray aliens, which I believe come from other worlds 37, you know, light years away, such as, you know, Zeta Reticuli. But that the grays are no longer able to reproduce. They are all females with no natural males because the Y chromosomes of their species degraded long ago. And so they have to reproduce by the infusion of fresh DNA and a very complicated process of replication in order to maintain enough diversity in descending generations so that they're not wiped out by, you know, any kind of a microorganism or problem within their own endocrinologies. And just as Michael Crichton said, you had to infuse frog DNA into old dinosaur sequences in order to get a replicatable strand in his old Jurassic Park series, I believe that the gray aliens have been doing that with us for a long time. Them and other factions are here for our minerals, for our liquid water, for our various salts, for the DNA that is within our bodies, and perhaps the DNA of other species in ancient times, such as Homo erectus, which, you know, may have been the lineages that led to some of the neo-giant hominoids that have been described, you know, like Bigfoot and that sort of thing, and some of the higher-order apes. I believe that DNA is harvested and that it is applied. And so these different factions ranch different communities. The most desirable communities are those communities with the deepest gene pools. Those are to be found in places like Malaysia, Brazil, Mexico, the Latin American countries, Indonesia, and all portions of the globe where the races have mixed to the maximum degree possible. The reason that is because, like mutt dogs at the pound, you have the healthiest and largest groups of generally healthy people spending the least amount of money on their own health care. You see, there's less diabetes.
They would have to survive their environment, so they would be tougher, and their DNA would be hardy.
Exactly. There's less diabetes and less heart attacks and less cancer and less endocrinological diseases in people of complex mixed racial origins than there are of people from specific racial origins.
Yeah, they're removed from the gene pool.
Well, they're not removed from the gene pool. They've just deepened the gene pool to the point where Mendelian genetics has its maximum degree of diffusion of the negative traits. So what ends up happening is you've got less of a chance of getting diabetes or heart disease or high blood pressure or sickle cell or whatever when you were born and raised in Malaysia and you've got Chinese blood and black blood and French blood and Spanish blood and you know, Polynesian Islander blood and, you know, some Australian Aborigine blood and all that mixed in equal portions throughout your family tree going back 50 or 60 generations.
Well, my point is that when a generation develops diabetes and they are, through modern technology, allowed or facilitated to live, obviously living a fairly normal life, then they can live long enough to reproduce and they pass the diabetes or the asthma or the cystic fibrosis on to their children.
And you're absolutely correct about that, because us diabetics and autistics, myself included, are still horny little, you know what, that, you know, like to breed like rabbits.
Right, bunnies.
I have autism in my family, and people claim I'm touched by it. My children are definitely and provenly touched by it, especially my youngest son. And I am a type 2 diabetic, and my father is a type 1 brittle diabetic since he was a child, who now is fighting type 2 diabetes on top of type 1 diabetes all at the same time at the age of 73. So, you know, the deeper the gene pool, the less you have to worry about this stuff, which is why you see more UFO abduction going on in Malaysia and Mexico and Brazil than you see happening in the United States and Western Europe and even Africa.
Yeah, we just get the animal mutilations here. But let me ask you a question then. So that's one race, or maybe two or three or a half a dozen, but are there races of aliens that are here to help us, here to help us transcend or to join the community of galactic travelers?
My witnesses state that a small portion are benevolent and nurturing in their attitudes toward us. The way Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey were benevolent and nurturing toward chimpanzees and mountain gorillas. The vast majority, however, harvest with an attitude of a businessman. And that brings me to the veterinary model of the harvest. Yes, and people ask me all the time, why do they not land on the White House lawn? Why don't they announce themselves? Why don't they set up shop as kings of the world and process us the way Adolf Hitler and Heinrich Himmler processed human beings in the concentration camps? And I'll tell you why that is. Ask any cattle rancher or sheep rancher in Australia or Argentina or the United States, what's the smart way to ranch your cattle and your sheep? Do you go in on horseback with dogs to isolate and select portions of your herd to cull? Or you go in with your Hummers and your Jeeps and your helicopters and stampede the crap out of them. And they'll tell you that if you are stressing your herds with Jeeps and helicopters and Hummers, that your animals are going to lose weight, they're going to become sickly, and your veterinary bills are going to go up. And the amount of materials processed from the carcasses of those animals are going to decline. So you don't want to apply stress to your herds. Instead, you go in quietly on horseback and with dogs, and you very quietly select, without a whole lot of fanfare, which portions of your herd that you want to cull from the main portion of the herd in order to receive your profits. And that's done.
And these points are what your witnesses are telling you, right?
That's just a trend, the common pattern in the 248 witnesses that I have. You don't want to stress people out and cause them to have internal conflicts. You don't want civil warfare. You don't want, insurrection inside of countries. You don't want every country of the world to turn into Iraq and Afghanistan. You don't want the disease associated with the destruction of the infrastructures that happens when internal populations lock on to each other.
And how is it that they are allowing our world to be...
Because they're ranching us quietly, and they're taking what they want, and they're doing it quietly without applying any extra stress above and beyond that which we do to ourselves. It's the smart way to ranch human populations by not announcing themselves and operating in secrecy. That's one less thing to stress us out and one less trigger to... global bush wars and tribal wars throughout the world. Because we don't have to worry about thermonuclear destruction all that much. What we have to worry about is different populations fighting each other on every continent, interfering with the crop growing cycles on every continent, with disease spreading on every continent. Because with death comes disease, with war comes disease, with disease comes whole sectors of the population that are weakened and then eventually die.
Well, let me ask you this question. Why is it, and I have not spoken to but maybe half a dozen abductees, but I have spoken to tens of thousands of people who feel a very high level of elation, of communication on a very high and very uplifting and very hopeful, very mind-expanding, almost artistic communication with beings or entities from either this dimension or other dimensions or orbs, They feel at peace. They feel loved. They feel overwhelming love, unbelievable, unconditional.
They'll find portraits of those. They'll find portraits of those kind of beings at alienufoart.com, and it's mirrors by alienufoart on eBay.
But why is it then that the vast majority of people feel?
It's not the vast majority. It's a specific minority to feel that, and their experiences are real, because just like Jane Goodall and just like Diane Fossey were real, you know, simian anthropologists and simian behaviorists who studied the chimpanzees and the mountain gorillas and truly loved them, so too are there factions of aliens or individuals within alien factions that treat us in a beloved way, the way we treat a beloved pet. And so these people are experiencing a real sense of nurturance. They're experiencing a real sense of emotion. But the vast majority of the reptilians and the grays are unemotional. The emotional component of their experience as mammalian beings, you know, and probably humanoids in origin, is long gone. They are ancient species, they're old, they're tired, they were selected, you know, probably 10,000 generations ago for extinction, and only through artificial means have they maintained some aspect of their population, because their population has an obligation and a relationship with the technology, which is artificially intelligent to varying degrees, but requires an organic system user in order to maintain its maximum potentials. In other words,
would,
the organic system user, huh?
Why would the governments of the world cooperate and keep secret this kind
because
of...
Because they're over
activity.
The barrel. Because if they don't cooperate, they will simply be eliminated and replaced. Because, you know, they live in fear, and well, they should. Every government of the world is over the barrel by these various factions, and they can take us at any time. And those who are smart know it, accept it, understand it, and operate within the rules that have been established by these beings.
I have to say something. When Bill Clinton became president and he went to Washington with all these ideas that he was going to set up basically a global soup line and everything was going to be hunky-dory, I saw him go into a meeting with not politicians but with bureaucrats, people that are career. They've been up there. They know what's going on. When he came out of that room, his face was white, he was quiet, and all of his policies changed after that. After that, it was party time at the White House. All of his plans to do great things with this country went away. I got the feeling that he went into a room, and the bureaucrats sat him down and said, "Okay, Bill, we don't know how you did it. You know, 55% of the nation voted against you, but you're here, and this is the way it is." And things changed from that point on. Now, I want to add to that, I was sitting on top of the Temple of the Moon in Teotihuacan a couple of years ago. It's a little bit of a struggle to get up there. It's 8,000 feet at the base, and by the time you get up there, you've got lungs coming out of your mouth. But it takes a while.
I've been at the top of it, same as you. I've also been at the apex of the Great Pyramid in Egypt.
Well, when you sit up there, and there are other people, other tourists, and most of them local from Mexico, come up maybe a couple hundred miles to sit up there, and you start up a conversation with these people about how the city was built or how do you feel about UFOs and aliens, I don't see fear at all in them. What I see is a tremendous kinship with whatever it is that's visiting us, because unlike apes, unlike simians, we have a soul, we have intelligence, and we have consciousness that's extremely powerful and divine in this universe.
My witnesses suggest that the kinship that you're describing is with indigenous cultures that predate the Industrial Age. However, the Industrial Age and those governments that maintain nuclear weapons technology, you don't see that same relationship anymore. I guess the best way to say it is, for the native indigenous cultures, such as the Aborigines of Australia and some of the Hohokam people of the desert southwest, and some of the indigenous cultures throughout Central and South America. There's a long-term relationship that has been maintained with some of the more benevolent factions for a very long time. That relationship does not exist with the governments and entities and agencies that control nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction technologies. Weapons systems tends to negate the relationship based on what my witnesses have told me. What you're saying is true with specific groups and specific populations. But again, I caution you to understand, benevolent interaction with aliens is a minority experience. It is not a majority experience. The majority of people feel like they've been treated like lab rats, that they've been treated like guinea pigs, that they have been treated as, you know, a harvestable commodity. They feel raped. They feel emotionally raped. Some of these people come up with the most insane pseudo-religious concepts in order to try to glue the shattered remnants of their psyche back together. It's kind of like male rape phenomena. Women survive rape and exist as survivors of rape much better than men. And that's in every culture of the world.
Well, let me ask you one question, then we'll go to the caller. I have a friend, his name is Dr. Stephen Greer, and he says to me, when we sit down personally, face-to-face, that all of the alien abductions are done by our government with our craft.
I absolutely don't agree with Greer. A significant number of abductions are followed by, especially back in the 70s and the 80s, by the reabduction of the same personnel. In fact, I used to date one who was very famous from Newport Beach. She would be abducted by aliens, and then a paramilitary entity would reabduct her again and subject her to thorough and humiliating medical examinations. And what was happening was this paramilitary entity that's associated with the multinational corporate conglomerate that Nixon arranged to divorce from congressional and constitutional law back in the early 70s during the Apollo Moon program. That's called the 1969 Nixon Purge, for those who follow my research. But military abductions, the My Lab experience, and Greer is big on my labs. That happened to a number of individuals, including some of my own witnesses, who got abducted by aliens and then were immediately reabducted because apparently we have the technology to see UFO craft when they're hovering over somebody's house. We're able to isolate and identify the specific families and individuals that are being abducted and then returned. So then they're reabducted, subjected to thorough examinations in order to attempt to document just what the devil the aliens are doing with them.
Hold on. Let's get this call in. Caller, what's your first name and where are you calling from?
Oh, hi. This is Crystal from British Columbia.
Hi, Crystal.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you. What's your question?
Okay, yeah. I don't have a question so much, but I do have a comment for your guest.
Sure,
I'm I guess what some people would call a contactee, but I really have to say that I've never felt like I was a pet. I can describe, I guess, much what you've mentioned, Brooks, that my experience was very enlightening. I mean, a spiritual awakening is the closest I could come to say. These beings that I was in contact with made it clear to me that we were on equal ground. I mean, they obviously have technology beyond our own, but at no time was I ever nurtured or coddled like a pet. You know, I kind of find that insulting. I don't think I'd want to be in contact with them if that were the case. They helped me to grow in my conscious awareness profoundly. And my life has change in a really wonderful way.
Well, this sounds like the kind of contact that I hear quite often as I travel through the community. I do hear the contact that Bill's talking about, too, but
at least
in my experience, the majority of it is like what you're describing, Crystal.
Yes.
Well, Crystal, I've already acknowledged that some people are indeed empowered by their contact experiences.
Yes, and
it's
I know
just that
there's
that they're
far
a minority and not a majority based
yeah,
on
Yeah, I know that there's far
interviewed.
More than like 250 that I got on the internet after my contact, and there are so many people, but we're quiet. You know, we're quiet about it because it's
I had to follow strict rules of science and contact in order
yes,
to document.
Yeah, I thought a lot about science as well when I by the time I got through my experience, believe me, I understand more. I understand clearly what you're saying, but I think because you've been focusing on that one group, you haven't been able to experience the vast number of people.
Well, my group comes from all over the world. Some of my witnesses are from the outback of Australia.
Sure,
and some are from Central America. And some are from North America, and some are from Europe, and a couple are from Africa. And six or seven are from Asia. And
they're all over the world. People have been in contact for so long now, you know, and it's I know like the media doesn't want to hear about these good experiences. It's flaky. You know, it's too new agey. I don't consider myself new ager. I'm not a flake. You know, but we do keep quiet about it because it's a personal experience, and we affect the people around us in a quiet way, you know. I can understand someone who's been abducted wanting to get their story out or maybe write a book, but, I mean, that's a whole different thing I don't really know too much about because that hasn't been my experience, and I'm not saying it isn't real. I'm just saying that when you say that the people who've had good experiences can be likened to Jane Goodall's apes and that, you know, that type of thing where we're being nurtured and that's not the way it is, and I just really wanted to make that clear.
Well, I appreciate that, and I want to add in that, you know, human beings, we understand to be eternal beings having a mortal experience. When our mortal body dies, our spirit continues on, and most people believe on this earth, in fact, Christians believe this up until the 5th century, that body comes, that spirit comes back over and over again in different physical existences.
Wow.
If our physical body is just like cattle to people, our will, our entity, our soul, the part that animates us, is eternal and has dominion in this universe, at least according to the words that we've collected over the last 20,000
years.
Well, it
has dominion.
Exactly, you know, and that is exactly the way. That is what these beings woke me up to. They said, "Do you realize who you are?" You know,
right.
And you know, when I said, "Oh, are you God?" and or are you, you know, are you some? I, you know, at first you think these must be wonderful light beings that are so much better than myself, and they made it so clear that no, you are not. You know, you are.
Hang on a second.
You are
as
great a being as.
Brooks. There's this lady brings up something that you know reminded me of something.
Okay.
In the UFO community at large, if you surf very carefully, and this lady's whole perception actually brings this out, not all space aliens are originated on other planets. There are some that came from this Earth in ancient times, prehistoric civilizations, that we no longer have much evidence for. Because of, you know, changes to the continents and sea level and everything like that. We're starting to find the foundations for these ancient cities, you know, on the continental shelves around the world.
Where
especially places like Cuba and Japan and everything. Now, there is a theory, a hypothesis, I should say, that some of the aliens that are coming back to Earth and that are being so nurturing and protective are, in fact, first-generation humans from ancient times that went out into space, and they've kind of come home. And that would account for, you know, this lady's perception and the perception of many other people like her. And it would also account for, you know, the relationship of us to angelic beings that, that have physical bodies we can see.
No, well, I'll tell you, it wasn't nurtured. I felt awakened to myself, to who I really am. And,
well, these people would have a vested interest in awaking you and me spiritually.
Well, I think probably I would know that they had a vested interest better than you would because it was my experience. And so that's what I wanted to make clear.
I just think that that probably in a cold war of sorts with the others that harvest us like cattle.
I also think that numerically they're probably not the majority.
Because
it hasn't been my experience, you know, and that's what I mean. Like, until you've experienced what I have and other people, you can't just go jumping to conclusions that you think.
Well, I'm not an experiencer.
Any more than
I have is running opinions based on trends in the information that I'm getting from my witnesses.
Yeah, well, my
opinion is
based on my experience, dear, and that's, you know, what you kind of, yeah, that's a very fine line to cross. You know, I'm not going to give my opinions on abductions because I've never been abducted. You know.
And I understand that. I don't think for a minute I don't respect the where you're coming from. My point is simply this. I'm a detective. I've been collecting information for 15 years.
And
I have running opinions based on the patterns and trends that I've found based on the people that I've found reliable.
Oh,
and many of them were military witnesses, trained observers from the military
origins. Because it really, it tends to frighten the public. You know, I mean, no one's going to listen to my experiences because I'm just Joe, the little lady that lives in a trailer park, as Stephen Greer would say, you know. And so I depend on people like Brooks Agnew and Stephen Greer to get the truth out. And I'm sorry, but
well,
people
we're trying to get both sides out, Crystal.
Well, I respect Dr.
It is clear that our government, most governments, are spending money, lots of money right now, weaponizing space.
Yes.
That's for a reason.
Yes.
I respect Dr. Greer a lot. I just don't agree with him on everything.
No, but I don't agree with
Dr. Greer on a lot of things.
But
that doesn't mean I don't respect
him. Experience. I don't agree with a lot of things either. But the thing is, I don't speak for other people about experiences I haven't had. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, well, this is might be what it looks like, but that might not be the way it is. You know,
well, I'm willing to acknowledge you and your experiences as having happened to you as real and legitimate. I'm certainly not going to sit there and tell you that you're wrong.
Well, it doesn't matter whether you think it's real and legitimate. The thing is, other people who don't know, I mean, you've got a strong voice, and it's your responsibility to be very careful what you say about these things because we're at a point in this world where things are changing. And we don't need unnecessary fear. You don't know that all the aliens are bad out there and we're all cattle. You know, like, I'm sure there may be some like that. You know,
I agree with Dr. Dave Jacobs. I believe that the majority of them are a threat.
And that they don't
belong here. And that from our concept
that.
Of right and wrong, they have no right to be doing
well,
what
I think
they're
that's
doing
a very dangerous opinion to put out because you don't know that. It's my experience and of many other people that just the opposite is true. You know, so, I mean, we all have to be careful. We all have to be responsible.
If they prove themselves to be good for human beings and the environment,
well,
I'm certainly going to be the last one to pick up arms against them.
Uh-huh. They've certainly been good for me and for a lot of people. Very enlightening.
Well, I feel exactly the way that the both of you do with respect to that. That if there are entities out there, and I have to say, I have had my own experience, although I'm not really being interviewed here, and I'm not really part of this radio program, except that I'm facilitating it, and that is that there is good and there is bad in the universe. There is here on this earth, and we are representative of the universe. So therefore, we know the grays are here. We know that they've been bad players. They're not getting a good press at all. They may be desperate. They may even be, you know, soulless hybrid drones.
Oh, I know. Well, we seem to know a lot about them. I mean, that's all we ever hear about.
But I believe there are the higher developed races out there that are benevolent and are concerned that our race will either return to the stars or will reach this point of metamorphosis where we become more focused on expanding out into the universe just for the sake of exploring and growing and procreating than we are concerned about blowing each other up. And I think we're very close to doing that, and that's a good feeling. I feel just like Bill does, that if there are aliens out there that want to help us save our planet, and we are watching it die around us, then I want to support them. I want to extend my consciousness and my will to them and invite them here that they can help us.
Yeah, well, I think that to me, it's not so much as inviting them here. I think they've already been, like, for me, I've already invited them by allowing them to help me awaken and raise my consciousness. Now they have gone because they have awakened me as much as they're not going to come here and clean up the earth for me. It's my responsibility now to take what I've learned and to grow with it and to make this world a better place. You know, I don't expect
that. And that's why we give you a voice here.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. And I should let you get back to your guest. I maybe take too much time.
It's not a problem, Crystal.
Okay.
Thank you so much for letting me speak.
Thank you, Crystal.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Brooks, this brings up a lot of things. There are people, Brooks, that have encountered a subset of the alien presence that is truly nurturing. Okay? And that's the correct word to use. There are also individuals who are fantasizing the nurturing element because it's the only way they can cope with what actually happened to them, if you follow what I'm saying.
Right.
In other words, it's my belief that certain abductees who are very, very famous in the UFO community and who have built very complex relationships with the aliens are, in fact, masking and cobbling together a cover story or a religion of sorts to assist them in figuring out a way to emotionally stabilize themselves after enduring something so profoundly terrible that they just have no other way to relate to themselves or to the situation. Again, it's the male rape scenario. Now, people like Crystal are going to be profoundly offended by what I'm saying, so I have to also say that that's not everybody. Crystal's not a rape victim that is experiencing something nurturing because that's something that she cobbled together within the confines of her own mind. She probably experienced something true and real that was nurturing. If it was real at all, then it was a nurturing experience for her.
Oh, it sounded real to me. It sounded like she had a marvelous experience.
It did. She sounds very relaxed in her life. She doesn't mind the fact that she lives in a trailer park in British Columbia and that she doesn't, you know, have, you know, Donald Trump's, you know, millions of dollars. She's probably very happy where she is. She's at peace with herself and her life. And that gives her a level of credibility in its way that my military and intelligence community people with their bona fides and their, you know, professional credibilities have in their way. So I respect Crystal. I take what she says at face value as much as I can. But Crystal's experience, again, in my opinion, is the minority position. It's the minority experience. It may be the profoundly minority experience. If she indeed encountered those that wish to be angels to the human race, then God bless them. Then you know, they're welcome here. But if they only seek to harvest and do harm and emotionally damage those that they take, then I'm ready, you know, to go into combat if necessary against them because, you know, it's us or them in that particular case. And you have to be prepared for either scenario. But again, I have to remind everybody that I speculate wildly and that these are my opinions and my opinions alone. I don't have proof that aliens exist. I only have anecdotal evidence based on what a large group of people have told me that have common patterns and trends. I am a detective. I am bound to the rules of interviewing multiple witnesses to a particular class of phenomena. And I have to limit my communications to those that are supported by the majority and the patterns and trends that are common to the majority of those people making the claims.
I understand your point of that.
I'm not a priest, and I'm not a president. I'm a detective. And so there are limits to where I can go with this.
Sure.
However, there is a way around that, Brooks. And that way around that is my artwork. Because I can take Crystal's experiences, and I can sit down at Crystal's trailer for the next 6 months, and I can sketch and draw all of the things that Crystal tells me over a six-month period, becoming Crystal's best friend in the process. And then I can put that information out as a portfolio. And people who observe that portfolio on the web or in an art studio or in a gallery somewhere can take or leave what they want from that artwork, because it's an exercise in fine arts and commercial arts. And when I draw my impressions of what people are saying, or when I draw meticulously in detail what specific people claim, I am producing artwork that all people can benefit from. Some people can say, this is nothing like what I experienced. Or people can say, this is exactly what I experienced. For instance, at alienufoart.com right now, there's a piece of artwork. It's called Midsummer Night's Dream at Mount Shasta. And that is my wife Laurie's dream that she had the week she met me at Mount Shasta.
Uh-huh.
And she was in a car with three of her friends, and all of a sudden they were in a rolling thing that looked like some kind of rotating ice tunnel. The vehicle was no longer on the road. It was like in the air. Then they were in this ice tunnel, and then all of a sudden she was like on this couch, and she was seeing orbs, and she was seeing manifested in front of her like holographic versions of platonic solids, and she saw alien beings, which are also in the drawing, and she saw remote devices that reminded her somewhat of those funny little balls that were in the Phantasm movies, only without any of the sharp instruments. In other words, they were not, you know, objects, you know, evoking terror or pain. They were facilitating. They were hovering, levitating tools that were facilitating the projection of whatever it was that those alien beings wanted to convey to Laurie and her two friends.
I've got you. 90 seconds.
Okay. So Midsummer Night's Dream, the original, is for sale, and it is available and is probably one of the most profound pieces that I've done based on the experiences of one individual. And Laurie...
Was Laurie's experience negative, or did she feel elated and positive from that experience?
She's ambivalent toward it. She feels very much enhanced by the whole understanding of platonic solids. She had no background in math. She was a realtor. And she knew contracts, and she knew how to count, you know, money and calculate percentages and things like that. But she had no background in Pythagorean theorem and no understanding whatsoever of geometry, everything. She skipped that part of high school, you know, partying. But, you know, all of a sudden these abduction experiences occurred, and all of a sudden she has an extreme understanding of the mathematics of the geometry and the symbology and the relationship of these symbols to crystalline objects in nature and to certain kinds of devices and tools of a higher order. And so that experience and the ones that followed subsequently to that, she considers positive rather than negative. She does not exist in fear of the aliens.
Right.
Not whatsoever.
And I think that's the majority of what I hear out there. When I go to the expos and I go to the conferences, I do see the abductees, but most of the people that I talk to have had experiences like what Crystal's spoken about. They have this
positive
nurturing.
Well, that's because folks like that tend to congregate.
Related. Yeah, well, I understand
they
that.
They congregate at those expos and conferences.
I understand. That's my data set, and you have your data set, and I...
My data set, I deliberately picked people who wanted nothing to do with TV, conferences or any kind of a limelight, because that gave me another defensible line of credibility for these witnesses.
I've got you. Well, listen, Bill, I have completely enjoyed the information that you've brought us tonight, and I appreciate even more you weathering your voice in light of the fact that you just got over something that's been going around, and you've held in there really well for 3 hours.
And, well, I'd like to ask a personal favor of our listeners.
All right.
There's three things. The first thing is please go to alienufoart.com and look at everything that Lori's done over the past 5 years that's on our website. She has single-handedly, and again, as a result of her abduction experience, she's taught herself computer, taught herself front page, taught herself image processing, and all of a sudden had these technical skills and abilities that she had never before manifested and had no background whatsoever. Please check out
download to me.
And that's what I was saying. Please check that out. That's the first request I have. The second request I have is if you're listening to Brooks and you're a publisher, especially somebody in association with any of the publishing houses in New York, please get a hold of me. I have short stories and manuscripts completed and in development, and I need a publisher. And the third thing that I need to ask everybody to do is to remember the Host Pros at thehostpros.com. They're the people that carry our website. When we were dirt poor and didn't have two nickels to rub together, they carried us with no limitation of bandwidth whatsoever based on faith. Mark Williams is the name of the guy. He does outstanding customer service to us. He's carried us since the 20th of September of 1998, and he's taken good care of us the whole time. That's Mark Williams, ANW.com, stands for anewworld.com, or thehostpros.com. And you have to include thehostpros.com.
All right, my
and
friend. Take care of that voice.
It's an honor to be working with a physicist such as yourself.
I
really appreciate your time over the last week. And if you need me again, just get a hold of me.
I've got you. I got your email address and your phone number, and I got to go because I'm under time constraints. Thank you.
Yeah, have a great week, Brooks.
All right, you too.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, my friends, we here at X Squared Radio try to give everybody their shot. We want them to state their case. As I tell you, the results are always positive in here, and I apologize to Crystal if she felt like she was slighted in any way, but that's no problem. She's welcome back here anytime. My experience is a little similar to hers. I hope that I don't have an abduction experience like unto that which was reported here tonight. That's all I can say. I believe that everything we do eventually affects the universe, and I think each one of us have a divine enmity that protects us against being taken over or herded. And I, for one, don't feel like I'm a cattle, but that's not to say that that's not their experience of those witnesses that Bill McDonald interviewed, and we appreciate him coming on the program. In any case, that is the end of our program tonight, and I will play my exit. Thank you so much. Just remember, we are divine. Here we go. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.